When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We always hear about the money roller coasters that pro athletes go on, but there's one category that's an even steeper roller coaster of money challenges. That category, stand-up comics. Today's guest, Bob Wheeler, is the rare combination of stand-up comic and CPA, world-traveling marathon hiker and money therapist. And he's the CFO of the famed Comedy Store in Los Angeles. The Comedy Store has produced the likes of Richard Pryor, Whoopi Goldberg, Dave Letterman, Robin Williams, and Jim Carrey. Wait until you hear how Bob is able to smooth out that money roller coaster that comes along with LA's glitzy show business. I'm Wes Moss. The prevailing thought in America is that you'll never have enough money and it's almost impossible to retire early. Actually, I think the opposite is true. For more than 20 years, I've been researching, studying, and advising American families, including those who started late, on how to retire sooner and happier. So my mission with the Retire Sooner podcast is to help a million people retire earlier while enjoying the adventure along the way. I'd love for you to be one of them. Let's get started. Bob Wheeler, welcome to Austin. Welcome to FinCon. I come here for just a few reasons. This is the mecca of financial talk and the mecca of finding cool financial people that are interesting to talk to and learn from. And there's only, I think, two restaurants that I've ever saved on my Google Maps. And I want to show you here on Google Maps why I'm here. I'm here to interview you in Austin and go to the Tamale House East, which is on right off of, I guess it's 5th Street and 6th Street. Yes. So have That's you close. Ever been here?
I've never been to Austin, but I love it. People are nice. People are really nice.
Wait, you've never been to Austin, Texas?
I've never been to Austin, Texas. Mm. I mean, I grew up in Tennessee, but never been to Austin.
So you need to go here.
I've been
to Austin a couple of times, and every time the first time I was here, I stumbled across it. I was here for my little brothers. I have four. I'm one of four siblings, and my younger brother got this was his bachelor party.
Oh, sweet!
This is like 5 or 6 years ago, and I remember walking up and down 6th Street trying to find a place to eat, and nothing was open.
Yeah,
and there was this little place. Way back, it looked kind of far away, almost like in a cul-de-sac, in an Austin-style version of it. And there was a sign that said something like, open since 1950.
Right.
And if anything's ever been open that long, you know it's got to be
somewhat good.
It's got to be good. So we went there, and it's a pretty magical little place. And the tamales, I'm unrivaled.
Sweet.
So I'm going there right after this interview. All right. So there's a lot of reasons I want to talk with you. Number one, you are the CFO of the world famous Comedy Store in LA.
I am.
but also, if you were to do a filter of humans in the world, there'd only be one that is a comedian and a CPA, and you're a CPA.
That's true. Although Bob Newhart was also a CPA.
Was he really?
He was. He worked at the California Department of Sales Tax.
So for our audience that may be too young to know Bob Newhart, tell them who Bob Newhart is.
Oh, man. He's this brilliant, brilliant, dry-humored comic who had a couple of TV shows. But brilliant, if you go back and listen to his albums, which I had to go search, he is hilarious.
When you say albums, meaning his comedy albums.
Like, right. He had albums. And he actually started off doing stand-up comedy reading the California sales tax code.
Oh, like how ridiculous it is?
Yeah.
No kidding. Like, what do you remember any of it?
There was something like, if you are deceased, you must do these certain things, right? So it's sort of like hard if you're deceased to do a lot of reading. So I always thought things like that were...
And you have a new book, The Money Nerve, yeah. Navigating the Emotions of Money, which we're going to dive into. But I think that I'm just so fascinated because I do a lot of public speaking, and when you're speaking, it's particularly about money. And I started in the investment business 25 years ago, and for the first decade or more, when I would do talks, they're always about just the economy. It's like the consumer spending and housing and interest rates and manufacturing and employment and what's the latest worry of the day. And it was all money, 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 economy, economy. What's the market? And then teaching about the market. You've got to be in the market so many days. It was very investment focused. And those talks are always at best like a C.
Yeah.
They're never that good.
They're great if you want to go to sleep at night.
They're never good. And I've heard 1,000 of them.
Yeah.
And they're never any good.
Yeah.
And so I probably heard 500 financial talks in my life, and they're all, barring maybe 3 or 4 of them, they're all forgettable. So once I wrote a book, once I started writing and having books, I was able to bring more to the table than just like, hey, what's happening in the economy today? And those talks got to be much more fun and entertaining, going through money and happiness research and marriage. My latest book has something about sex in it. So everyone's like, oh, tell me about the sex slide. But
that's right.
But what is when you're speaking, though, because I have been bored so often in these talks, I want them to be fun. So I want it to be kind of fun and entertaining, and I want people to have fun and laugh. But that is, it's not easy to do when you feel like, hey, I got to entertain. So I've always thought there's a few jobs I think are almost impossible. One is like maybe being the president. That's a hard one. Two is being a stand-up comic. Mm. So tell me, that's what I want to talk about first, is like, how did you get into that? Were you just like always funny, or are you funny more when you're on stage? Like, tell me about that cycle.
Yeah. So I think I probably was always funny because that was easier than fighting. I could just run quick. I was little. So I either had to run or make people laugh.
Bob is not 6'8", by the way.
I didn't make it into the NBA. water boy. And I was always doing comedy and people, oh, you're funny. Being funny and doing stand-up are not quite the same things. But I got into sketch comedy first, and you have other people. So that was more comforting because if the sketch bombed, you could say, well, it was Billy. Like, it wasn't me, right? It was them. But then at a certain point,
And again, tell us what sketch comedy is.
So sketch comedy is improv, or what you see on Saturday Night Live, where it's already written out and there's 6 people doing a sketch, you know, Coke, Pepsi, Coke, you know, kind of thing. And so the stand-up was sort of scary, but for me, I was not a person, unless I knew people really well, I didn't go out and talk to people. I could be really invisible. But with a microphone, I felt like I could say, like, I hate you, or I could be angry, or I could do all the things that I wasn't supposed to do in real life because I was good, you know. And so comedy gave me the freedom to actually say stuff that, even though I was hiding behind a very small microphone, it felt very safe for me.
Is it because you don't see the crowd, or is it you just don't know the people, so it felt like you could go to another place?
Well, because I could feel like it was an alter ego. So I could just say, you people suck. Just kidding. Like, you know, I judge everybody. No, I don't. Because we do. And so I could say things and I could see the audience. I like seeing the audience and like knowing that they're there to have fun, right? And so I don't know. For me, it's a lot of pleasure, and there's nothing better. It's the best drug in the world when you have 500 or 1,000 people all laughing. Even if you recite the alphabet, you're like, this is pretty
sweet. This is cool.
It's pretty sweet.
What was your first stand-up? How many years ago was that?
Oh, probably. So that was probably 20 years ago. And I was fortunate. My first year went really, really well.
When you're stand-up, how much is somewhat, is it totally spelled out, or is it kind of bullet pointed out? How regimented is Do you know you what
have,
you're going to say?
You have a premise. So you know, I'm going to tell the story about my family, or I'm going to tell the story about camping. And I might know some main points, but I don't know all of it. Because if you're up there just, and so then I went to, it's boring. It's got to be in the moment. And as long as I know my key points, and even I actually had a joke about Pet Value Days,
tell me this story real quick. What is Pet Value Days?
It's the day you find out how much it costs medically to save your cat before you determine if your pet has any value, right? Like, you gotta go, right? And so, and I would always say, well, I draw the line at $500, okay. right? And actually, it wasn't me. Visa draws the line at $500, right? And so it's that, and people, when I first told the story, I didn't have it honed, and people are like, you're evil. You would kill a cat. I'm like, everybody makes this choice sometimes.
Yeah, we
right?
always have to get to that.
They're cheaper at the pound, you know, and I love him, but, you know, my cat, you know, it's how much, you know? And so, and then the joke gets, he comes back and he goes, well, actually, it's going to be in the neighborhood of $5,000 to save your cat. I'm like, oh, my cat doesn't want to live in that neighborhood. You know, I'm like, I'm out. I'm okay. out. Right. So, but then finding that place where it's funny and people don't hate you.
It took a little while.
It took a little while. Probably took about 6 months.
Well, okay. So did you inherently, were there a lot, was a lot or is, cause you're still, you still do this live once in a while at
once
the Comedy
in a while
Store.
Right now it's, I do. It's hard right now to get up a lot because what would happen is, do a set. People are like, oh, that's funny. I get off stage. Hey, Bob, can you come sign a check? Hey, health department's here. I'm like, could I just like for 5 minutes, like revel in the laughter and then go back to being.
Because you're full. So when you CPA can take off a lot of roles, you can be a CPA and a CFO for a company. And in this case, the company's the Comedy Store.
Right.
But are you a practicing CPA that does taxes too or no?
Yeah, so I actually have an accounting practice with 1,000 clients.
Oh, wow. That's a lot.
And I brought on a partner a couple of years ago.
It's a lot of tax returns.
It's a lot of tax returns.
Yeah.
And a lot of babies.
Yeah. A lot of dependents, right?
Yeah.
A lot of dependents.
I work with a lot of creative folks, so a lot of adult babies too.
But, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I love them. I love them all. I love babies. But yeah, so, and actually what's interesting, the Comedy Store, when I first was doing accounting and stand-up, because I was stand-up, you know, paid the bills, and then the accounting was
it
just
did,
my
it
passion.
It did pay the bills.
No,
okay. I'm sorry. Like, what?
It's actually, yeah.
The other way around. So yeah. CPA work paid the bills. Okay.
Yeah. And when I, and so when Mitzi called me, because my good friend Vicky Barbalak from America's Got Talent was like, hey, Mitzi, Bob's a CPA. He can help. They owed like $100,000 in payroll taxes.
Oh, wow.
It was a bad situation. And I realized they had no money to pay me, really. But there were three stages at the Comedy Store. All my friends were comics, sort of had a skill set. And I thought, okay, I sort of got to help. But I really just want to be a comic. And I realized, though, I had to make my other accounting practice be somewhat successful so that I could give time to the Comedy Store. Because for years, I didn't get paid very much.
So it was like almost like a nonprofit for
you. It was
a
nonprofit for many years. True anymore. But
do these places, do they undulate? I almost think of these comedy places where you hear of like, oh, this, Chris Farley came from here. And you know, Richard Pryor came from your play, from Comedy Store in L.A. Yeah. Like, lots. Who are some of the names?
Oh, Roseanne Barr, Robin Williams, Richard Pryor.
At the Comedy Store.
Yeah. Jim Carrey, Roseanne, like Sandra Bernhardt, Whoopi Goldberg.
They were all there.
Craig T. Nelson.
They all came through there.
Michael Keaton.
Wow. Yeah. Do you go through these phases, and I think about maybe even Saturday Night Live like this, where you do have a kind of a rock star cast, and then it might undulate to like nobody's a real rock star and it's kind of weak, and then the Comedy Store doesn't do well, and then you get a couple home runs. Does it undulate like that?
Absolutely, absolutely. So when I first came in, it was crickets at the store. We would do a show if there were at least three people in the audience or five people, you know.
And that low.
Like, hey, you want to come in? Like, we'll pay you to come in. You know, comics were just like, please, please. So we could do a show. And it was.
Well, how the hell did it stay in business then? What how did it even survive?
Because Mitzi was determined to succeed. And she mortgaged the house. She mortgaged everything.
Tell our audience who Mitzi is.
So Mitzi Shore got the Comedy Store in a divorce, but she actually came up with the name of the Comedy Store. Her husband, Sammy, and another gentleman started the club, mm-hmm. but she ran it and created it, made it into something. And
then they got divorced and she took it over.
And she took it over.
Yeah.
And I think partially what happened, because she used to say, you know, the improv people hate me. And I'm like, oh, Mitzi, you're crazy. But there, you know, Bud lost the improv in New York in a divorce. And so I guess he rechanneled his energy when he got to LA, sort of at Mitzi and the Comedy Store. So she was determined to make it succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And so she mortgaged everything. People don't realize how much debt she...
Just like any other business. Yeah. Like an entrepreneur who's really doubling down.
She's like, we're going to make it happen. And I think, like for me, the coolest thing in the history of the store, I've been there 25 years, is that by the time she got sick and when she passed, we had paid off all the debt and had turned the club around so that she was.
What was the inflection point? Who was there? Did you save the Comedy Store? Or was it
multiple people?
What were the comics that kind of brought it out from the depths of despair?
Well, I mean, I think at different times, you know, when she first started the club, J.J. Walker was brought everybody in the club. Mm-hmm. And then it was Richard Pryor and there was Robin Williams.
And like during those periods, like when Robin Williams and Richard Pryor, like he was, not really many people bigger. There was a time when he was a local guy or was right. he already national at that point?
No, these people, all David Letterman, you know, was hosting every night and he was ready to drive back to Indiana. And Mitzi's like, no, you got to stay. And so these guys were just people that mm-hmm. were not known. Jay Leno.
Those are all Comedy Store guys. But they were awesome. And then like early on, three people, how many people would then get packed out in a full?
You know, in the last couple of years, we were doing three shows a night in the main room, packed out every single show.
How many people fit?
400 in the main room, 150 to 200 in the OR and 50, theoretically 40, 50, maybe 70 in the belly room.
So again, tickets are what on average?
20, 25 bucks.
But it really then kind of pulled it out. And then how do you get something as, it's almost like I think of comedy almost like a football team where you're drafting and you're hoping it's going to work. You're bringing in people. Is it a little bit more sustainable now? How do you make it more sustainable?
Well, you know, I still think comedy goes in cycles, mm-hmm. you know, and there's lots of clubs. Pandemic shut down a lot of clubs. Mm-hmm. But I think the art of comedy is something that is always going to be needed and always going to be around because it's a voice of truth. And even in stressful times, I mean, Austin has 10 clubs.
Mm-hmm. Where are we in that? The business, really, we're talking about the business of comedy. I think either Kevin Hart or somebody more recently has been complaining that like it's in the world we live in today where you can't say anything before you get canceled. And we all know that we're in a hypersensitive world and you can kind of get canceled for anything. Isn't that harder for you guys now? Or maybe not for your jokes.
Right.
is it more difficult though right now?
I mean, I think it is. I think people are more sensitive.
David Spade. It was David Spade. I just read an article that he said, I'm just so scared to say anything these days. Or is that just a PR stunt on his part?
No, I think it's true. I think people are really, really sensitive. You know, she said this or he said that. I mean, it's comedy, people. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't need to walk in super activated, just looking for, you know, come in and just look to have some fun. So I do think people are super sensitive right now. And I think there's a lot going on in the world. So people are super amped. You know, we've been enclosed in our homes and all kinds of things. So it is hard.
Transitioning more to the money side. So your track is that you were a CPA already. Mm-hmm. You're also a stand-up comic. You're mm-hmm. working there. You kind of take over the books. You're the CFO now. Mm-hmm. And you're still the CFO.
Still the CFO.
And during that period of time, so what would you talk about from a money perspective? So you mentioned our pets have value, which is my favorite part about comedy is to take, and I guess Seinfeld is a good example of this, is just to take the same thing that all of us go through as humans, like right. the pet thing.
Right.
And in my mind, I've never really thought of it as funny, but it is kind of hilarious. And we all have had the conversation.
Right.
Like Lynn just the other day was like, oh, well, Josie, we have a shepherd and we have a big lab and Josie's getting older and Josie, right. like now she has to take this because her spine isn't great and she can't go on walks. And then she's like, but there's a new therapy that we can do. And she gets an injection once a month. And it's something like it's like Humira, like, you know, on Phil Mickelson.
Right.
It's like 60 grand, you know, I don't know, a year or something. Like, I love Josie, but sick. I mean, like, seriously? I was like, are you kidding me? Like, it's that? Come on.
No, exactly.
What kind of neighborhood is that, by the way?
Yeah, exactly. Saying it's a good thing they don't have kid value days, right? Because you'd be like, Billy.
I know. I guess that one is probably, that's still unlimited. But when it comes to a dog or cat, now Mallory, our producer, she has 7 cats.
What?
So I think actually the number's lower for her because it's multiplied by so many cats.
She's probably lying too, because it's probably like 12 and she's already feeling the shame at 7.
When a cat person tells you they have five, that means they really have 10. There's a cat multiple.
That's right. That's
actually,
right.
I really don't. I think she has one. Her cat's name, like Peanut or Pumpkin Lice, Pumpkin Spice Latte. I can't keep up with all the names. There's so many.
That's right.
But okay. So today, how much of your routine do you talk about money items, or is it only once in a while when something hits you?
Well, you know, mostly my humor is, making fun of myself, dark humor. I go dark. But I don't talk about money a lot because people don't really find it that interesting, you know? Mm. I mean, I do some jokes about that stuff, but my joke used to be, I'm a CPA, which stands for can't pay anything, because I was broke as hell, but
can't pay anything,
like if you've got the credential, like banks were like, whatever Bob says, you know, I'm like, oh my God, if you knew, because my finances were terrible when you like, oh, I'll be a stand-up comic. It'll bring in millions. And that was a dream. And
it's like pro golf. Where there's like 10 guys that make a ton and nobody else makes any money. Is that kind of the way it is?
Yeah. And so a lot of these people, they're making $20 a night.
$20?
Yeah, we pay 20 now.
$20 a night.
Yeah.
Okay, for the whole night.
15. In the main room, it gets split. There's different ways, or certain people get door deals. And it's not a lot of money. But as an accountant, I was terrible financially. I knew what to do. I knew what to tell other people to do. I just didn't do it myself.
When did you come up with the concept of money, the money nerve, and then tell our audience about this? And how much does it have to do with, to some extent, you're coming from a very interesting place. It's even, we always hear about the plight of professional athletes. It's like only a certain amount of percentage from even college, only 5% of college athletes can go to pros. And then some of them, only a few of them actually make huge money, and most or 90% make good money for only 2 or 3 years and they spend it all. It's probably worse in comedy.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. And it's so, like, I have friends that have made it big and now they're back to not making it big. Like, they're just like living in a studio apartment. Right. And at one point they were super famous. They were on a couple TV shows
and now don't have money,
like had so much and lost.
When you say so much, like what's a, go back to the early 2000s. When you say make it big, how much is a comic making?
I mean, $5-6 million.
No kidding. And those are, and no, would that be a household name, or is that like pre-household?
No, household. Mm-hmm. Doing stuff on television and, you know, Saturday Night Live, all those things, doing venues.
And then it goes away?
Then it goes away. Bad investment choice. I have a lot of clients that are actors and things, they'll think, oh, this series is going to go on forever. You know, it's a limited series. There's only 6 shows. It's going to end. Right. But they'll keep thinking they're going to make $1 million an episode. And, you know, I had a client who came to me, goes, they canceled the show and they've offered me, now they only want to pay me $50,000 an episode instead of 300. I said, really? How many other shows are you being offered? He's like, came back. He's like, I took the 50,000. I'm like, yeah, like, you're living in a bubble.
Yeah. And these are creatives. You're an interesting kind of both sides of the brain,
right?
I guess you've got,
that's right, left brain, right brain.
But a lot of comics are just straight up, I guess it's right brain. Straight up right brain. And they'll have a run for a couple of years and then it can dry up very easily.
It goes so quick. Or like in today's culture, somebody says something offensive and all of a sudden your money sources dry up, right? You get canceled. You're not in the show. They cancel your TV series, take you off YouTube. Whatever.
Okay, you can get, have comics gotten pulled off YouTube?
I don't know. I just,
yeah, maybe.
Just make
cancel culture YouTube.
Yeah, wow.
Deplatformed. Terrible. Well, all right. So then I guess, is that what goes it? Tell me about the money nerve.
Yeah. So what happened? It was a combination. I was looking at my own life of going, wow, as a CPA, you're doing terrible personally. Mm-hmm. but nobody can know, right? You got to like present well. And a lot of my clients that were in the creative arts but weren't comics were coming to the tax sessions, were turning into therapy sessions, and people were telling me stuff that they probably shouldn't have been telling me. And I'm like, oh my God, there's all this. Like, what is this? Everybody's got this shame. And they're like, I don't want anybody to know. And I filed bankruptcy.
Well, give me an example. Yeah, I want to hear about this. And you obviously, you don't have to tell any names, so nobody's going to know who these people are.
No. So I had people that had filed bankruptcy or nobody knew that they were on the verge of bankruptcy and they were signing deals and misrepresenting, or just that they were so ashamed that they had $200,000 or $300,000 worth of credit card debt and everybody thought they had this amazing life.
Whoa.
And so I was seeing that all the time, especially in LA. And just there was so much debt and people were living way beyond their means and telling me like how poor they were. I'm like, you just put $1 million in your bank account.
Mm-hmm.
You're not that, you might, you know, cash flow might be tight, but you're not poor. You're mm-hmm. like, go to India. That's poor.
Yeah.
And so, but people would share these stories and they would start crying. I have lots of Kleenex in my office and people would tell me things. And I was at the Comedy Store one day in the main room and one of my friends came in and she was crying and she's like, you know, I was just visiting my family who are all doctors and everybody's shaming me because like I chose to do comedy and follow my passion. I'm the stupidest person in the world. Mm. And I said, man, listen, I see most of those people's finances and their tax returns. You're not the stupidest person in the world. And most of those people that you say you want to be like, you don't really want to be like, because they're driving around in a fancy car, but they're spending their whole month trying to figure out how to pay for that fancy car and that fancy house. And they're in complete stress and they're freaking out. She's what?
Yeah. Even so, you're talking about now non-comics at this point, yeah. right? Because LA is
producers, directors, actors.
Oh, a special place where it is. I guess I can't think of another place where there's more glitz and the image. Maybe for our audience, it's in Austin or yeah. in Kansas or in Michigan. Can you paint up just a little picture of what is that even like? Like people really are out spending way, like you've yeah. seen $200,000-$300,000 in credit card debt?
Oh yeah. Like a lot of people.
Really?
Yeah.
And what are they buying with it? Like what's the lifestyle they're supporting?
You know, I have a client who spent $100,000 on clothes, mostly like $200 pairs of underwear and $100 pairs of socks.
Wow. I'm just in shock to yeah. think about this. I'm like,
that's a lot.
Because we hear about overspending, but I guess there's nothing like LA. And is it yeah. because, is it your tip? So you're talking, we're talking about the money nerve here. Is it just the same keep up with the Joneses thing, but on steroids out in LA?
I think so. And I think there's also this, like, look at me, I'm special, right? LA is a little bit, you know, narcissistic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dare I say. And it's like, look at me, look, I'm more special and I've got more followers or more people like me and I drive a fancier car. And so there's this presentation that I think a lot of people get sucked into.
And then real estate out there, right? To buy a house in LA.
It's ridiculous.
It's like, I mean, a house in LA is, I mean,
yeah, $2 million gets you like a shoebox. It's awesome.
So just the house purchase can throw people quickly yeah. into real leverage, right? I mean, I would think just a house, you could end up with a $5 million house. It's not even that amazing.
That's right.
And you got to have a huge inflow in order to pay for a $5 million house.
Yeah, absolutely. Or win the lottery or have, you know, inherited wealth. I mean, there were a lot of people probably in the mid 90s, early 2000s, a lot of clients of mine made a whole bunch of money on their houses, even though it still continued to go. And then they all moved back to Texas. They moved back to Tennessee. They moved back to Florida when they had kids because they thought, well, I don't want to raise my kids in LA. Mm-hmm. And I've made so much money on my house. I could go take a normal job. Mom and dad can babysit the kids. And so I had a lot of clients moving out of LA once they
get in, and the house almost saved them.
Yeah.
The house appreciation.
Yeah, absolutely.
And are these people that go from like the movie business, the arts, entertainment, comedy to like normal jobs or not normal, just something totally separate?
Yeah, a lot of them do. And I think most people, LA is really seductive and fun. And then after a while, it's exhausting. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you go to other places and say, wow, people aren't so stressed out. People aren't trying to kill you in their car or assault you when you just sit down at a park.
Well, how do you handle LA then?
I don't know. I love LA. I mean, you just, you know, carry a gun and kick people. No, I'm kidding. No, I mean, you have to.
Carry.
That's not nice.
Yeah.
You have to be really aware of your surroundings. Like, you know, if I'm out downtown, I'm not running around going, hey, and I, you know, I just sort of keep to myself, but mm-hmm. walk with a purpose. It's getting worse with the homeless. I've had people knock on my door. Hey, can I, you know, I'm just like, and you got to try to find that balance of not getting completely negative and all that.
Easy to point out a lot of bad things in LA.
Easy to point out a lot of stuff.
The money nerve is about the emotion of, so emotion, how do we work through that? And what do you talk about baby steps to do this?
Yeah. So basically what happened for me was I realized that people were making decisions emotionally, but unconsciously.
For example.
So I had a client who every 3 years, her business would get really, really successful and then it would fall apart.
Hmm.
And I'd known her a while. And so finally I said, hey, you know, I'm curious.
What industry?
PR.
Okay.
And so she would make a couple $1 million and that would go for 2 or 3 years and then it would just completely fall apart. And so we started just doing, because I also have a little bit of a therapy background, counseling. So I, because I'm bored.
Bob Wheeler, comic, CPA, therapist. Yeah. Jesus, Bob. But
you got to do something. Got to fill the time. So I asked her, we started looking and it turned out that she didn't think her mom loved her when she got really successful. So she would crash the business. Her mom would come in and save her. And then she knew her mom loved her. And then she would start over. So I said, like, maybe you could just ask her to give you a hug and tell her she loves you and not go through this whole freaking drama. She's like, I didn't realize that. So there's a lot of that where people are unconsciously sabotaging. I had a client who his business was going completely under and he got offered a job, like $250,000 to be a partner at this firm. And he would have everything paid for it, would have gotten him out of debt. And I said, you know, you should go for this. He said, my parents will be really disappointed if I close my business. I'm like, it's going to go under.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, yeah, but I'm just going to have to let it go under. I can't proactively close my business and make a healthy choice.
And it did. It went under.
And it went under.
How often do you see people that do get some religion, understand, the therapy almost works, they go through enough issues that the PR example, the business example, do they ever almost rectify it and solve it and kind of go into a new chapter? And how do they do that?
Well, you have to get real and it's not fun.
Mm-hmm.
I had a client who came to me and he said, my business is going to go under. And I looked at all the stuff and I said, well, you have to lay everybody off. You need to lay off everybody, but maybe two people. And he said, well, I promised everybody that if things got tough, that they would all have their jobs. And I said, well, you're going to have to go back to them and say, I overpromised.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I don't know. I'm going to have to think about this because I made a promise. I said, well, it's going to cost you. You're going to go under. So he came back to me and he said, you know what? I laid everybody off. And he whittled the budget down to nothing. He got rid of two or three of the buildings and everything. 18 months later, he got a bunch of high-paying jobs with a bunch of studios. He hired everybody back.
Oh, wow.
And he turned the company around. And now it's like we're always trying to figure out how not to pay taxes on the millions of
because
dollars.
Because he's killing making. It, yeah. Well, and also California, you've got the not
state tax, you know,
is massive.
12%, 13%. Continuing.
I think that's the other thing. So if you're a big earner and you hit it big, you are really paying a full 50%, right?
You are.
Straight up 50%.
You are.
Yeah.
You are.
And you got to really love California.
You really got to love the beaches. You do.
But it's almost impossible to afford being on the beach.
It is. Man. Well, that's like 20 million.
At least.
Yeah. You know.
Only in California.
Only in California.
Well, any coast actually. Now, even like the Gulf Coast, where that's the closest to in Atlanta. We can drive about 5 hours south, and you go to the Gulf Coast. And it used to be affordable, like not like a lot of places in the United States. It got really unaffordable, really expensive, and then COVID, the prices went up almost 50%. So yeah. To be on the water went from five to it crept up to 7, 8, and then it just jumped to 15. So now to be on the coast in the Gulf of Florida is like $15 million at this point.
It's insane.
So baby steps. Now you've done a lot of travel. Done some crazy travel like India, China, Nepal, Egypt. Yeah. What's that about? What are you doing?
Well, you know,
what are you doing on your travels?
What are you doing? I'm crazy. So my first trip was running a marathon in Greece. I ran the original course, not the original marathon. I wasn't old enough, but a friend. And so that was my first trip. A friend said, hey, do you want to go to Greece? And I said, well, only rich people can travel. I'm not rich. I can't go. And he's like, you're an idiot. And I went, what? I can travel? So that was like my first breakthrough on mindset. And so I traveled. I met this woman in Greece at the at the Parthenon, and we got to talking and we became friends. And then she's like, I got to take you to Africa. I'm like, is there a marathon? She's like, cool. Yeah. So we would go.
Oh, wait, so you went for a marathon.
So we went, we're going for a marathon.
Because
it's got to be practical, yeah. Right? You got to have a reason to
travel. But are you doing marathons at all these places?
I was, not anymore.
But what are the places? I've never heard of anybody travel. I hear of people traveling for triathlons to Hawaii or Australia, but they have never running.
There was a marathon at the base camp of Mount Kilimanjaro. So we hiked Kilimanjaro and came back the next day and we ran a marathon.
What?
Yeah, who did I know?
Wait, Kilimanjaro, I thought that was one of those, takes a week and oxygen tank.
It takes about 3.5-4 days to get there. And then on the final...
You mean to the summit?
The summit.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's... and don't eat the chicken, because they were carrying chicken and stuff and it was not refrigerated. I just ate a lot of popcorn and peanut butter. But we got to the top and... you go to sleep in the afternoon and then at 11 o'clock at night, they wake you up and you make the final descent because it's so hot during the day. And they didn't have Diamox, stuff like that. So
what is that? What is Diamox?
That helps your blood thin so you don't get altitude sickness. Mm-hmm. So we all got altitude sickness. So you're and we're walking to the top like zombies. And
At night.
And then we get there at sunrise and it's just gorgeous. And you're like...
But you're ready to throw up.
Beautiful, yeah. And it was amazing. And then most everybody just slid down back to the next, where our base camp was. My friend, she's like, I'm not going to slide down. We have to zigzag all the way back down the mountain. I'm like, that's great. So we zigzagged back in extreme heat. It was fun.
So you did. So you've done Kilimanjaro. You've mm-hmm. done, and then you ran a marathon after that? Or that was the marathon?
Day. No, the next day. Ran a marathon.
Yeah. So you were in amazing shape for a long,
back
long
then,
time.
Yeah.
Gosh, it's amazing.
Well, I was kickboxing and doing all this other stuff. So
what? So I guess to some extent, there's a lot there. Is that you've got the cost of travel, what these things taught you. How would you play that into the money nerf?
Well, I think for me, I would just, the first couple trips were on credit cards and paying it back later was not fun. Mm-hmm. But when I went to Nepal a few years ago, we did the first day and all my friends went, that's really freaking hard. Let's just go back to Kathmandu and get massages. And I'm like, no, I just paid a lot of money. We're going to finish this trip. And I didn't know what to do because nobody wanted to continue. And me, I wanted to get my money's worth. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, what about this? Let's just hike for an hour and then renegotiate. We'll decide if we'll hike another hour. And so we hiked the first five
days. So you're with a group of how many people?
There were six of us.
And you went to go do the hike mm-hmm. in Nepal.
In Nepal.
And how, day one, they're after the first day.
At the end of day one, everybody's like, let's just go back tomorrow. And we hadn't even gotten out of the national park. We were just hiking. It's pretty extreme, but mm-hmm. you hike through and then you've got, your 15 days of
trekking. So five out of six say that we're going back. And what did you say?
I just said, let's hike for an hour and then decide if we're going to hike any further. And so they were like, all right, we'll do an hour. So we hiked an hour. You want to keep going? All right, we'll do another hour. And so we just did it in hour increments for the first 5 days. And then after a while, people were like, all right, we'll go further. we're already here. But yeah, that was just me trying to figure out how not to lose my money.
Yeah. Well, what did it teach you then?
But it taught me that when whatever we do, if we take digestible bites, if we take baby steps, I think most people, especially in LA, but I think everywhere, people are trying to get from A to Z. Mm-hmm. And if I can just get people to focus on getting to B and then getting to C and then to D, and then eventually we'll get to Z, or maybe we won't, but we'll have a great time on the way. And we're going to be in each moment as we're getting there, instead of just trying to blow past all the hard work and just arrive.
So from a practical standpoint, that really does apply to our finances, and then really particularly in the world you live in, which, and the A to Z mentality, listen, that's not just in LA.
Yeah,
that's,
for sure.
It's everywhere. Sure. And there's some value to having bigger aspirations, mm-hmm. but to your point is look, the reality is that 99% of us don't go from A to Z.
Right.
99% of us have to go to, or I'm sorry, A to Z.
Right.
99% of us don't go from A to Z right away. We methodically get there.
That's right.
And do you teach that as a CPA?
I teach it in workshops where I do workshops around money and emotions to just help people start to realize. I mean, yes, I certainly talk about that as a CPA because I incorporate a lot of that when I'm working with my tax clients.
So wait, you do talks about money and emotion or the emotional impact of money? What is that? Yeah. What do those focus on? Is that a big part of it? Or
yeah, so I do workshops. I've been in front of like Transamerica, Ameriprise, all those, talking to financial advisors and talking to clients about like, what do you want? What's your story? Because most people say, oh, I'm broke, instead of I'm cash poor at the moment.
At the moment.
Right, at the moment, or lots of moments. Or, you know, I'm broke. And yet they just spent $5,000 taking a trip to Acapulco, right? And so trying to get people to be more honest about what's true, and then having people look back at their history and see how that played a role. So for example, I had a client, she was very averse to success, and she realized that she didn't like her mom as a single parent going out and working jobs to feed them because it wasn't ladylike, because all her friends had moms that made lunches for them. Mm-hmm. So she's like, I'm never going to be like my mom. And so she would just push away at anything and not learn anything about money until a little bit later when it wasn't serving her. And she said, this isn't good. I need to do something different.
Adverse to success.
Yeah. Many people are adverse to success.
Why do you think so? That's
interesting. Well, because when you have success, people will judge you. People will not root for you to go further. You have to have boundaries. You have to be able to say no. You know, and I think for a while with me, that was my story. My mom, when my parents got divorced, said, you have to make enough money for all your siblings and I to have the life we deserve. And I have four siblings. And I thought, I'm not paying for five other people.
What would you, would you get an NFL contract? What are you doing?
They just decided I was going to be successful with money because I liked money as a kid.
And you're a CPA.
And I'm a CPA. And even then, when I was thinking about money as a kid, money's greedy. You're greedy. I'm like, okay, but you want me to have lots of it so I can give it to you. Well, I'm going to stay broke so that I can honestly tell you I don't have any money. Instead of learning how to say, hey, you go out and make your own money and I'll go out and make mine. And if I decide to share it, I will. But not because I'm guilted.
And have you done some of that, or have they gotten some religion around that?
Yeah, no, we've had some good come to Jesus moments with with my family and me being able to say, like, this is how it is for me. Mm-hmm. Painful, but in the long run, it actually more authentic relationships and actually being able to be honest with each other.
God, what an amazing combination Bob Wheeler is. There's so many different pieces that you put together. You're like a totally new version of the gig economy, right? And your gigs are all different. I don't know if I've ever seen the combination of comic, therapist, CPA, speaker, writer. And when did you write Money Nerf?
I actually wrote it about 8 years ago and then just updated it.
This edition is the brand new one.
Yeah.
That people can find on Amazon.
Amazon, or there's the ebook version on the website.
And where do people find you? What is your website?
TheMoneyNerve.com.
TheMoneyNerve.com.
Because it hits a nerve, right? You win the lottery, we get excited. It's visceral. You overdraw your bank account, you almost vomit.
Yeah. Man, what an amazing continuum you just described. Bob Wheeler, thank you. Super, super interesting. You're the only comic we've had on, and very cool to hear your story.
Yeah, thanks so much. Oh, I appreciate the time, and I hope people out there like become the best versions of themselves and get conscious and intentional about their spending. That's what I want to do.
Help. Enjoy Austin and FinCon, and maybe I'll see you at the tamale shop.
Sounds good. I'll be there.
All right, Bob.
Hey, y'all. This is Mallory with the Retire Sooner team. Please be sure to rate and subscribe to this podcast and share it with a friend. If you have any questions, you can find us at wesmoss.com. That's WESMOSS.com. You can also follow us on Instagram and YouTube. You'll find us under the handle Retire Sooner Podcast. And now for our show's disclosure. This podcast is provided to you as a resource for informational purposes only and is not to be viewed as investment advice or recommendations. This information is being presented without consideration of the investment objectives, risk tolerance, or financial circumstances of any specific investor and might not be suitable for all investors. It is not intended to and should not form a primary basis for any investment decision that you may make. Always consult your own legal, tax, or investment advisor before making any investment or financial planning considerations. Please refer to the full disclosure in the podcast description for any additional information.